You are listening to Get Psyched, a Psych Sign podcast. I'm your host, Arizu. Today, we're continuing our chat with Dr. Tan Nguyen and Dr. Bhagwan Baru, two psychiatrists working in the new field of nutritional psychiatry. If you haven't listened to part one of our conversation yet, go ahead and check that out. If you're just coming from that episode, welcome back. Let's get back into it.
It's not just the alcohol in this, right? It is the fact that we're potentiating other factors, such as in this case, microbes, that enhances maybe the bad outcomes of alcohol.
And something else you had mentioned was that, you know, once we take the alcohol out of the context and we're adding sugars and things like that to it, that certainly, I would imagine, plays a role, which leads me to my next question. What roles do substances like sugar, amino acids, cholesterols, and triglycerides, which are main components of our nutrition, play in influencing our mental health?
So before I venture to answer that question, I'd just like to add something that came in my mind while Dr. Tan was talking is, we have come to some understanding what is good and what is not good for the microbiome. And now I'm going to fall back on an old adage that too much of a good thing is not necessarily a good thing. So everything in moderation works even more effectively than too much of one thing. And now we've come along the fact we pretty much know that good nutrition plays a vital role in the prevention, development, and in the management of most health conditions, mental as well. We also know that a proper balance of complex carbohydrates, essential fats, amino acids, vitamins, minerals, and let's not forget water. They all support good neurotransmitter activity, which is the basis of most mental conditions. And they protect us from the effects of oxidants, which can create havoc. So not only are we maintaining good health with these nutrients, we're also preventing some of the effects of bad nutrients if we put good nutrients in good enough, adequate quantity. So coming to some of the specific items that you've asked about, I think definitely sugar, amino acids, cholesterol, and triglycerides, they all play a role. And I'll come later to some examples, but I'd like to ask Dr. Tan, what is his opinion about these four items that you have asked us about?
Yeah, and again, kind of like the microbiome, when I first kind of like think about it, I'm a little overwhelmed because they are very big topics. So just like a good mentor once told me, think with complexity, speak with simplicity. He was also a Marine, so maybe that played into it. But the thing that I actually want to circle upon quite a bit is actually the idea of sugars. And specifically in this case, refined sugar. So, you know, I think in the context of evolutionary biology, as kind of you were mentioning before, right? Once upon a time, we had to expend or exert amount of calories or energy or joules, whatever it might be, to attain said calories, nutrition, minerals, and sometimes sugar. But in this case, it is such a easily accessible item now that imbalance of expenditure usually is not there, right? So, for instance, you can imagine that once it became much more and more easily accessible, the balance of continuously either eating it or knowing when to stop eating it becomes harder and harder to differentiate. And so that touches on the idea a little bit about like how, I guess, addiction can play into, I guess, something as simple as sugar. But they have gone as far, and I've seen some papers out there that come up with a certain scale called the processed food withdrawal scale. And, you know, this was in processed foods, but this is also in the same argument with refined sugar, where they noticed that if there was more of an abrupt change in, say, their diet of processed food, they noticed symptoms of withdrawal. Maybe there's a little more proof of concept to the idea that, yes, sugar very much so has a very big impact on our mood through our gut, if we allow it to. We have also seen, at least in my child and adolescent work, is that there is a correlation between the control of that consumption of sugar and the idea of attention, impulsivity, or some of those clusters you see with ADHD.
Yeah, I think that it is significant to have that finding that you just mentioned about the relationship between sugar and some of those characteristics we see in a population with ADHD. That's huge, I think, to make that connection. And wanted to also highlight what you said about how evolutionarily, if we take that perspective, we aren't built, per se, to take in this much sugar or even this many calories, right? And so where we might have had, I mean, some, you know, depending on where you are in the world, but particular to this country, where you might have had issues of, you know, malnutrition and things like that. I mean, I guess you could still argue that we, you know, we still have undernutrition, but overconsumption in this country. It's an interesting paradigm and paradox that we live in now, that we have access to foods, cheap foods in some cases, but they don't provide the right nutrients we're looking for. And so then you find a population with issues. Then you have an epidemic of metabolic diseases like diabetes and hypercholesterolemia and things like that, because the diet is not optimal for us as a species, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you know, I don't mean to like vilify sugar, because we're recording this just right before Halloween, and like,
yeah,
I'm going to buy a bag of Reese's and I'm probably going to eat like a quarter before I give it away. So this is going to be, I mean, we'll talk probably a little bit more about this as to like how it's been ingrained into basically kind of the cultural things that we do as well. But let me finish your question really quick. And the last three I kind of want to touch on is like the amino acids, cholesterol, and the lipids, right? The triglycerides. I call it the steak triad, right? So when you think about it, it is like the red meats, right? You have your proteins, right? You have your cholesterol as well as your triglycerides, just all on this beautiful plate. And I will argue to say that part of the culture now has been centered around the idea of having red meats or meats as the centerpiece. And then it is accompanied by, say, mashed potatoes or collard greens, right? Where once upon a time, it was more so a addition of flavor, right? And just as a very minimal part of the entire meal. Whereas now it is like the 18-ounce porterhouse that you can just get at Outback. That's all to say that we do know that higher and higher consumptions of red meat do lead to worse and worse cardiovascular outcomes in a very particular population. And I think there is some signals in there that we should heed, right? Because as you were talking about the balance of how calorie expenditure and gaining is becoming a little bit more in balance for us, I can argue the same with red meats. Also, side notes, amino acids, right? Glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter found in like MSG, which is in Parmesan cheese, soy sauce, and shiitake mushrooms, and NAC, N-acetylcysteine, has basically just blown up in our world of psychiatry. I don't think there's been a conference where I have not seen NAC mentioned, but we've seen that there are some benefits to it, right? When we prescribe it, the benefit might outweigh the risk. And in this instance, there's promising evidence towards obsessive compulsive disorder. So when we get down to like the nitty gritty of like the very specific amino acids, yeah, we can potentially see some signals. But again, it's out of context of how you'd usually be getting it. So I'd be careful with too much of a reductionist mindset.
Exactly. Yeah. While it's worthwhile to look at individual components of what's in our food and what's contributing to either better or worse health outcomes, it's also, like you said, so important to keep in mind that taking these nutrients and individual components out of the context of what they normally exist in can kind of reduce that impact that you expect to see. When I listen to a bunch of nutrition podcasts just to kind of get a wider understanding of what's going on in the world of nutrition, because there's so much happening, but that's kind of what I've heard over and over again is like, if we identify a specific individual substance that works well for certain things, you take it out and you package it up as a nice supplement, it doesn't work as well. And so that's why it brings me back to the advice that I've heard over and over again is eating whole foods is the best way to go to get your nutrition. If you don't have access to certain nutrients, then that's when you would supplement. But rather than taking the route of, okay, nutritional medicine is taking, ramping up, let me add X, Y, and Z supplements to my diet. No, that's not how we should look at it. It's how to change our diet to incorporate the foods that are going to, bring you good health. Yeah. So I appreciate you providing those examples with regards to ADHD and then OCD. I think it's important to recontextualize it within the field of psychiatry and remember that these do have large implications for our patients. But I also wanted to ask about the potential influence of certain diets or foods on addiction, since Dr. Bari, you do have a background with addiction psychiatry as well.
Well, definitely. It's an important aspect of nutritional psychiatry that cannot be left behind, because addiction psychiatry, there are so many different models of interconnectedness of nutrition with addiction, both ways. It's a multi-directional influence, if I may call that. It's not just one way the direction goes. Addiction does not lead to one malnutrition as the only example. In fact, malnutrition and addiction are like two parallel tracks that go together to make the situation even worse for the person who is consuming those illicit and licit substances, as I may call it. Number one, first item is we will often see deficiencies of a particular vitamin in alcoholic consuming patients. And in fact, it's a universal fact that whenever they come to the ER, they're always given a dose of thiamine before anything else, because we know thiamine deficiency can create havoc in an alcoholic. On top of that, there are certain illicit substances such as opiates, cocaine, which have their own unique influence on the gut microbiome and also on appetite and so many other areas that a multi-pronged approach needs to be implemented to bring them about. We all know that when these are all in recovery phases, any good rehab program always includes good nutrition along with other factors to influence a good outcome, and the relapse is minimal. So let's take an example, addiction and poor nutrition. I imagine an average person going about his daily business, making money, having a reasonably good living, not extravagant. Now he falls into the trap of drinking more and more alcohol. The money that he would have normally spent on good nutrition is now feeding his drinking habit. What happens to food now? Food will take a backseat. Now he's no longer concerned about good nutrition, but about drinking more and more alcohol. So the money that could have been utilized for good nutrition is now going into a different place. Nutrition is definitely going to suffer. There are some points, and I would want to elaborate on them, though I don't know how much time we have. Like, why do people in bars get peanuts as a side item? And that may be a topic for another day when we are talking more details. But bottom line, the fact is that once you get into a habit of using a substance, nutrition is no longer as important in the mind of the person. That's one thing. And whenever healthy recovery is obtained, you always have to pay attention to good diet and nutrition. We all know complex carbohydrates will help in the production, facilitate the production of serotonin. On the other hand, Dr. Tan mentioned about amino acids. We do know that once we have a good amount of amino acids, we're definitely going to improve upon those same neurotransmitters, which will help us better. We also know about fatty acids, omega-3 and omega-6, and how they help improve, reduce inflammation and improve brain function. So all these combined, there is no way somebody can discount and say nutrition is not as important as it should be for every person who's addicted. And let's not forget one other population, which we never really pay attention to, is those who are elderly people. How much of elderly population has come under an addiction of food items? And I'm not even talking of alcohol or other illicit. As they have recently come up, University of Michigan produced a report about how the elderly population is addicted or almost addicted to sugary items. For them, cakes, ice creams, donuts form an important part of regular daily meal. That's another aspect, because with that comes the fact that now good nutrition is not there anymore. And that particular population who may have certain cognitive deficits get worsened with refined sugars and high levels of fats.
Yeah, I think that my understanding from what you were saying was that good nutrition, or the nutritional side of things, when you're dealing with an addiction, it comes from both angles. You're both not focusing on obtaining good nutrition and maintaining that, but you're also having the direct negative effects of the substance you're taking. So it's all like a two-pronged effect from both angles. It's important to remember, I appreciate that you mentioned that last caveat with the more older populations, where addiction is sometimes even hidden in plain sight, right? It's not necessarily an alcohol addiction or an opiate addiction. It can be an addiction to food itself. And that's not to be confused with not being an addiction, but rather now you're still having the same effects of over-consuming sugar and under-consuming the other important aspects of your diet. So I think the parallels are definitely there. And I think something that this leads me into asking is how the connection between food, culture, and social connectedness influence mental health. Because as we've been talking, you know, these things have kind of come up in our conversation, talking about the social patterns and behaviors related to food. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. And, you know, let me actually start off by saying, you know, when I first came over here to Dr. Baru's place, and he was like, "Tan, would you like some coffee?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'd love some coffee." He brings me a cup of coffee and he gives me a little tidbit to say, "Hey, I put a little bit of cardamom in there." And he shared the idea that for his culture, if there is a certain amount of cardamom in your tea or in your coffee, there is a social signaling of, in a way, wealth, or sometimes even social class. So that is signaling to say, like, hey, in this home, we have what we need and we can provide. And I was like, wow, is there such a better example to kind of bring up for a podcast on nutritional psychiatry today, especially when it comes to culture? Yes, there definitely is a tie towards food, culture, but more than anything else, human connection. Let me first kind of like highlight how we in the United States have began to approach the idea of food. And the example I give is from a book I read, where they say, you know, that if you were to ask someone in France, hey, let's go eat some cake, their response usually would be, oh, what's the celebration? Here, the question usually is, how many calories is that? I don't know. So usually it has now been reduced to, again, the reductionist stance of like the calories, as opposed to the more abstract stance of maybe like social glue. The upcoming holiday we have is Thanksgiving, right? And, you know, when most people think about Thanksgiving, there's like, oh, what are you going to eat? What's your favorite thing to eat at like Thanksgiving, right? And you can imagine that you're going to be at home with your family or whoever you call as family with a lot of food around you, right? And that's like the thing, like there has to be like a lot of food. You can't not overeat. And you tell someone else about it and they're like overjoyed to hear it. But then if you have the same amount of food and you take away everyone else and you leave yourself, now people are worried about you. And I think the thing that that highlights there is that, yes, Thanksgiving sometimes is about the food, but I think the role that it has for us primarily is the social glue that can bring people together, as cheesy and corny as that sounds. Maybe like my dad jokes are really getting to me here, but I definitely wanted to highlight that, right? That there is that purpose of like a sense of belonging to food and being part of like a ritual for us.
Oh, yeah. I think that even looking at different cultural traditions and religious traditions, there always seems to be an element of gathering around the act of eating, right? That seems to be a recurring theme in a lot of cultural or religious traditions. But it is interesting to see how that's changed over time, particularly in Western countries where food is an afterthought and then nutrition is an afterthought even after that, right? It's certainly we have occasions where we celebrate food like Thanksgiving or Halloween when we splurge on candy, but it's not in the same way that we, like you said, if you remove the context, it becomes an issue in our society. And I don't know whether that speaks more to the quality of food or the cultural traditions, but there certainly is a feeling of disconnectedness at times that we seem to have potentially lost. And I don't know whether that's a product of our times or a cultural thing again, but it's certainly a complicated issue.
Yeah, you know, there's a social glue part, but part of it is actually just like potentially nostalgic tradition as well. For instance, the example I'm going to give you is that on New Year's, the Pennsylvania and Dutch here eat sauerkraut and pork. How do I know that? My wife creates me sauerkraut and pork. She never makes it any other time during the year except during the New Year's. I'm like, why do we need to eat this? Because it brings good luck. I'm like, but I don't know if I like this. And he's like, it's good for you and you're going to need the luck ton. And I'm like, whoa, calm down, Katrina. But like that in the context itself, right? And if you Google, like Google Trends, sauerkraut and pork, it only comes up once in the annual year. So you can imagine that goes the same for like turkey. How much turkey do you eat throughout the year and what social context does it actually bring you? Anyways, I digress. But it does speak to some of our social behaviors surrounding food in itself.
Yeah, I think that it reminds me of a course I took in undergrad that was looking at food and society and just some of the ways that we've lost the connection we have to our food. Typically, even just a few hundred years ago, we were 10 times more connected to our food. We raised our own stock, our own livestock. We grew our own harvest, and then we harvested it with our own hands and, you know, sat down together and ate it together and knew exactly where our food came from. And more than likely, I want to say that people in at least in Western and more so even Eastern world now are not as connected to their food. And then I think that that obviously has brought nutrition to a wider, you know, has saved a lot of people from issues of starvation and hunger, but then has brought along its own new set of problems, right? Because again, too much of any good thing can be bad. And so this is when you see the bad side of things, the disconnection from our food, the you know, relegating it to an afterthought even, thinking of food in only, you know, very reductionist ways even. So I think that's a whole conversation to be had. Like, could spend so much time talking about the role of food in society has changed, but I did want to move forward and look at our next question. We've touched on this a lot throughout the episode, but I wanted to kind of gauge your your opinions on how you think we can practically incorporate nutrition into psychiatric care to actually have a good impact on patient outcomes.
That's really the bottom line, right? How do we do what we need to do to make sure that the patients get good advice? So let me tell you a little bit about myself, because that's where it comes from. I'm a product of the 70s as far as medical schooling goes. When in my first year of medical school, there was a mandatory course of what is used to be called nutrition and biochemistry. It was one book. While biochemistry expanded, nutrition was no longer considered important. And I don't know what the current medical situation is, but I was told by some medical students recently that nutrition does not form part of medical curriculum anymore.
Not even a chapter.
That, I think, is a step backwards rather than forwards. I am glad I came from an era where nutrition was considered important enough in the medical field. And while I have always paid a lot of importance as far as what patients eat or not, it's only recently, in the last decade or so, that I have created this whole scenario where I will never let a patient go without giving them advice about what they should and should not eat. So it has become part of my initial evaluation. When I evaluate for sleep and appetite, I also ask them, what are their daily meals like? How many meals do they eat? What do they eat? So that forms the very basis of an evaluation for me. After that, it becomes easier for me to elaborate further in my future appointments, giving them advice about what they should be eating and what they should be consuming in smaller and smaller quantities and what they should be paying attention more. It was a little difficult in the beginning starting that topic, but it is becoming easier and easier. And I find patients also quite open to those suggestions. They feel like I'm giving them more than what they came for. They came for medications, and while I'm prescribing medications, I'm at the same time talking about sleep and food and extracurricular activities and relationships, which to me forms a complete part of mental health management. So coming to, we don't have any guidebooks as far as what mental health foods are. We have guidance from the FDA. In fact, the government keeps modifying their stand on what food should be. Used to be pyramid, used to be, now it has come down to my plate. And if you look around the world, every major government has its own style of creating what is good for them and not for them. In fact, some come in the shape of a heart, some come in the shape of igloo. Ours is my plate. It's fascinating how different governments vary in their opinions about, but all of them I have seen or read are all about physical health. No mention of mental health. Why that is, I can't address. But I have made it mandatory for myself to always not only ask for the diets, but also ask, what do they like in foods? What do they dislike in foods? Why do they do that? And many a times these habits are ingrained quite early in their life. Foods become a part of regular day-to-day activity. Many of them don't even think about what they're consuming. It's just natural. They consume what they consume because it is normal for them to do that. Change is difficult. And sometimes it's almost bordering on the impossible unless they have to be convinced why they are. And I can tell you, it becomes easier in some and not so easy in the others, especially when I point out some of the deficiencies I see in people who drink alcohol. I can easily tell them, this is what it is. Your folate and B6 levels have gone down. The other thing that I have often seen, and I have made it a point to get every patient's vitamin D level done. And I am surprised at the number of vitamin D levels in lower ranges than in normal range, especially in our country. We live in a temperate zone. we don't go out as much in the sun, and the sun does not produce enough vitamin D in our body for 12 months. So if we do not eat vitamin D rich foods, then we have to fall back on a vitamin D tablet to make it in the normal range. And remember what vitamin D does. Low vitamin D is a risk factor for depression. Not only that, low vitamin D will also prevent the full effectiveness of an SSRI medication. So vitamin D, I'm just harping on one item. There are many other items like that. In fact, some of the SSRIs that we prescribe to the patient, they end up reducing the calcium absorption. So if we do not tell our patients to eat calcium-rich foods when we are prescribing an SSRI, are we doing them real justice? And how much do we know that by doing one, we are not doing the other in balance? I always suggest every patient of mine, fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, nuts and seeds, berries, definitely blueberries. They have been known to reduce anxiety. Lentils, legumes, yogurt, of course, we have spoken about it before. And last but not the least, some amount of fish, not every day, but occasionally having fish will give you enough omega-3 and 6. Have a balance of all of this. People call it the Mediterranean diet. They don't speak much about the Okinawan diet, which is equally good, or the Norwegian diet, which has also been known to be good. And lastly, I would like to add to that a new diet that has recently come into the fore. It's called the Indo-Mediterranean diet, where there are aspects of Mediterranean diet which have incorporated some of the spices from India to make it even more wholesome. So all this, it is definitely a field worth exploring more and more. And I try my incorporate. And I've had some good results from patients. In fact, those who have stayed with me for a while often come back and say, but remember, food does not work as fast as medications do. You can expect the results of an antipsychotic in a few hours on a patient. You can expect antidepressant in a few weeks. However, foods are not that quick. They sustain you, they maintain you, but they need to be done continuously to bring good health.
Yeah, I think that, like you said, and some people, I mean, when you're dealing with a population that's seeking psychiatric help, they just need something that works quickly and effectively. And there's no shame or, there's no need to shame someone for doing that. But I think as much effort and energy we exert as providers to figure out what's wrong with someone medically and get them on the right cocktail of prescriptions, it's equally as important to try to figure out what kind of foods do they eat? What do they like? What is actually going to be realistic? If I'm familiar with the Mediterranean diet and its positive effects, but then if you tell someone, you know, eating healthy proteins like fish, okay, well, what if they don't like fish? You know, being able to give them other options and not just have a cookie cutter answer for things. So that does take a little bit of personal, taking a little bit of your own personal time to learn about nutrition, because like we said earlier, it's not something that's emphasized in today's medical curriculum. And so it does mean that physicians that are passionate and genuinely interested in having these discussions with their patients, it does mean that they have to take on the extra burden of educating themselves on this topic. But luckily, there are certain things that are well established, like the connection between vitamin D and levels of depression, like the connection between calcium and SSRIs. And so as far as advice or resources for listeners that are interested in learning more about this field, what are your suggestions?
Yeah, not to be a hypocrite and be a reductionist to give maybe just a few sentences, but there are some really, really good things that I've heard that have stuck with me for a while. The first is, and this is to echo what you said, is to eat whole foods, right? Or how I like to see it is eat the foods that your great-grandmother would be able to identify, right? Or recognize. And so when you look on the back of an ingredient list and you read it and you're like, wow, great grandma would not be able to recognize that. Take caution, be leery. I'm reminded of like an Onion article where it's like, to the mental health providers and medical providers in the future that might find the long-lasting effects of daily consumption of Diet Coke. I say that with tongue-in-cheek because there was just a time when that's all people drink. And we really don't exactly know too much about aspartame, but regardless, that's my number one, ingredients. Be wary of them, be mindful of them, right? Number two is whatever you put in, know that it's also, or whatever you consume, know that it might affect the trillions of friends in your gut, right? And try and be mindful and kind to them if you can as well. There are some articles and research out there. There are two places that I would recommend folks going to if they become more and more interested in this. The first is the Center for Nutritional Psychology. And this actually has like continuing education like modules as well as a curriculum in case there are providers out there who want to integrate this into their practice just a little bit more or just want to know more of how, you know, all of this works. And then the second is something called the Psych Collective. And again, a lot of information on nutritional psychiatry. However, I'm a little bit biased towards it because it also talks about the gut microbiome quite a bit. And that's my love. So that is another resource if folks are thinking about diving into this topic a little bit more. And then there are the popular books out there from Michael Pollan, where he talks about, you know, like In Defense of Food or The Botany of Desire, The Desire of Botany. And he eloquently kind of spells out evolutionarily, historically, how we got to where we did today with our relationship with food. And it's, you know, it's a good read. I take months to read because it's like a few pages every night before I go to bed, but I'm pretty sure there are faster readers out there. But that's on my end. I don't know if you had anything on your end, Dr. Burrow.
Well, actually, I think I could add a few. There have been a few other psychiatrists who have been on the forefront of this topic. And two names that come to mind right now, and there are more. One is Dr. Drew Ramsey, and the other one is Dr. Uma Naidu. Both of them have a lot of information that they put out on the internet and on podcasts, which I find quite helpful and useful for everybody who's interested in this topic.
Thank you both for sharing those resources. I think that those are a really great place to start, but I think that everyone is interested in hearing about this textbook you're working on. That may be potentially a resource that we can use in the future.
Yeah, I mean,
any updates?
Him and I have put together our heads and we have a pretty extensive curriculum. And, you know, I don't know if people have ever written textbooks before, but it's not the fastest process. Even though we got the invitation and we've proposed the idea behind that, right? Their process of like answering back to us and getting back to us on how to move forward, it's usually internal and it's kind of like this black box that will come out a little bit later. In a way.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully you'll see our names out there on that publishing, if not maybe another one. So everything you've heard us talk about today more than likely will be in that textbook with the voices of other folks that we believe can actually be of quite value for us. I don't know if you're going to say that, Dr. Baru. I don't mean to steal your thunder.
No, go ahead and
but yeah, for the most part, it hasn't made too much headway right now, just because of the process. But I think we're still quite hopeful. If not, there are some articles that are planned to be out on, was it Psychiatric Times?
Psychiatric Times, yeah. They've asked me to write articles. I've already written a few, and they're in the process of editing it right now. You should see it in the print pretty soon.
Congratulations to both of you. That's amazing contributions you're making to this field. And I can only hope to aspire to be in the field with you one day and working on making those contributions, because it certainly is an exciting field. And I see exactly what you mean, Thon, because I am floored by the passion that Dr. Baru exerts for this topic, and I've been converted. I'm super, super excited for this field as well. And I appreciate everything you shared today. I will be on the lookout for those papers and awaiting those updates on the textbook, very eagerly awaiting those updates. So just wanted to say thank you for your time today. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and expertise with our listeners and with myself. And thank you for our listeners for tuning in today.